Iran's leader says Tehran will definitely take revenge for the U.S. assassination of the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani. U.S. President Donald Trump slams the Senate Republican Majority Leader for acknowledging Joe Biden's win in the presidential election. And a humanitarian organization that says continued conflict, widespread hunger, and a collapsing international aid will worsen the crisis in Yemen next year. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the Islamic Republic will take revenge for the U.S. assassination of the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Sayyed Ali Khamenei added that the revenge for Soleimani's murder is certain. The leader said that Iranian general, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January, defeated arrogance both during his lifetime and with his martyrdom. Further in his remarks, he warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Donald Trump leaves office. Ayatollah Khamenei also advised Iranian people and officials not to trust the enemy and to double their efforts to strengthen the country in economic, science, technology, and defense sectors. The leader stressed that the country should focus on neutralizing the sanctions instead of securing the removal. Ayatollah Khamenei also lashed out at the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, saying that they have showed utmost breach of commitments and hypocrisy. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshesh says that Iran's leader's remarks re-emphasize the country's strategy, suggesting that Iran will not budge or be subdued as long as the U.S. remains adamant to a conflict resolution approach.
We are speaking about one very important point here all throughout this speech today, that despite claims that the Biden administration and his win in the recent presidential election might change Iran's strategy and approach towards the region and towards the United States, Iran believes that the case is still the same, since President Biden has requested the same demands that Donald Trump did and Obama did. They want to contain Iran's power through talks, and Tehran is adamant and insists that it would develop its power components until the day arrives when the U.S. Would change and shift approach and strategy to respect Iran in action and not just words, as Obama stopped using the word regime for Tehran to show respect, but it was just verbal respect. Tehran wants respect in action, that they need to acknowledge Iran as a regional power, and they should not be looking for containing Iran or going for regime change. So it was a re-emphasis, a reiteration of Tehran's strategy, showing that as long as the U.S. is adamant to a conflict resolution approach, Tehran would not budge and would not be subdued.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has lashed out at the U.S. for imposing sanctions on his country over his purchase of the Russian missile defense system.
Since 2017, these sanctions under the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act were not imposed on any country but Turkey. It is being imposed for the first time on our country, a NATO member. What kind of alliance is this? What kind of partnership is this? This decision is an open hostile attack against our country's sovereign rights.
Erdogan further noted that Washington, with its measures, intends to block Turkey's defensive advances and make it dependent on the U.S. The president said that Turkey will overcome the sanctions, vowing to ramp up efforts to develop an autonomous defense industry. On Monday, Washington blacklisted major Turkish defense procurement and development body, as well as his head and three employees, over the purchase of S-400 missiles. NATO, of which Turkey is a member, says the weapons pose a threat to the alliance. The U.S. also removed Turkey from its F-35 fighter jet program last year, after Ankara defied calls to cancel the S-400 deal. U.S. President Donald Trump has criticized the Senate Republican Majority Leader for acknowledging the victory of Joe Biden in the November 3rd presidential election. Addressing Mitch McConnell on Twitter, Trump said that it was still too early to, quote, give up. He said the Republican Party must learn to fight. McConnell congratulated Biden on Tuesday, one day after the Electoral College officially affirmed his victory. The president has refused to concede defeat, claiming there was widespread voter fraud. Trump's campaign has launched a slate of lawsuits to overturn the election outcome but to no avail. Roman Mazzari, our correspondent in Chicago, says that the U.S. Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, has acknowledged Biden's victory because he sees little chance for President Trump and Republicans to be able to overturn the results of the November election.
You know, he's conceding because there's really not any way to reverse the results, you know, now. The next step is on January 6th, Congress counts the votes, and they can debate the votes, but because the Democrats control the House of Representatives, the House votes on any sort of debates. So it seems like it's really sort of a foregone conclusion, and that explains why McConnell conceded. However, you know, between now and December 6th, this country is still going to be filled with claims of voter fraud. You know, you have 1,000 sworn affidavits of irregularities. But voter fraud is a huge burden of proof on the accuser. And then they also have to prove enough voter fraud to swing the election. So that's even more proof.
The International Rescue Committee has named Yemen the country at the highest risk of a humanitarian catastrophe in 2021. The humanitarian organization has given the grim recognition to Yemen for a third year in a row. It says that continued conflict, widespread hunger, and a collapsing international aid would worsen the ongoing crisis in Yemen next year. The IRC has called for a global commitment to the country. It says 24 million Yemenis are in need of humanitarian aid, be it food, education, or health services. The organization says the majority of the country requires UN and humanitarian funding to meet their basic day-to-day needs. The humanitarian situation has been worsening in Yemen following the 2015 Saudi invasion of the country. The war in Yemen is taking a heavy toll, meanwhile, the health sector limiting patients' access to critical care. Kidney failure patients are among the hardest hit, amid the closure of most dialysis centers due to the lack of fuel. Abdulatif Al-Awashali reports from Sana'a.
A struggle for survival is what Yemenis face as a consequence of nearly 6 years of war under blockade by the Saudi-led coalition. Things are the worst for patients, especially those with kidney failure, due to the lack of adequate dialysis centers and necessary medical equipment to cope with the large number of patients.
The capacity of the kidney center is 230 patients a week, and we receive 528 patients. The patient does not take the necessary number of dialysis sessions, and we are in war and under siege, so that donors and international organizations should bear their responsibilities regarding the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Ahmed is one of the thousands of patients with kidney failure and is having a really hard time getting a dialysis session.
Some dialysis centers are closed, which has caused pressure on the rest of the centers, and there is a shortage of materials and dialysis sessions are hard to get.
The fuel crisis in Yemen is also piling up pressure on hospitals, forcing many dialysis centers to close down. Patients are also deprived of foreign travel to seek treatment due to the continued closure of Sana'a Airport.
The lack of fuel and the closure of most dialysis centers have increased pressure on patients by reducing the number of dialysis sessions for each patient, which puts their lives at risk.
The Saudi-led coalition and its regional allies launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 to return their protege, exiled former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, to power. The bloody aggression has killed thousands of Yemenis, including women and the children.
The lives of these patients are dependent on their ability to reach this center. Meanwhile, there are more Yemenis who struggle to live through the ongoing war, blockade, and famine. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Germany says it is prepared for all scenarios as post-Brexit trade talks between the EU and the UK are teetering on a knife edge ahead of the December 31st deadline.
There has been some progress, but still no breakthrough. But I think we still stand by our opinion that a deal would be better than a no deal. However, we are prepared for the latter.
Addressing the German parliament, Merkel also said that the talks between British and the European Commission would continue until the end of the week. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson expressed his desire for a deal, but said that the EU needs to recognize Britain's right to sovereignty. He said that the UK has a neutral right, like every other country, to be able to control its laws and fishing grounds. Brussels and London have been engaged in intense negotiations, but remain divided on key issues. Britain left the EU in January, but remains under the bloc's trading rules until the Brexit transition ends on December 31st. COVID-19 infections and deaths keep surging through Europe, with authorities in several countries imposing stringent restrictions ahead of the holiday season. The Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez has called the recent rise in infections worrying, warning that stricter measures could be needed for Christmas. The number of daily infections in Spain rose to more than 10,000 on Tuesday. Germany also went into a new partial lockdown from Wednesday to halt the surge in infections. The country reported a record number of 952 deaths and over 27,000 new cases on the first day of the lockdown. Elsewhere in Europe, Bulgaria has also planned to extend coronavirus restrictions until the end of January to contain the spread of the disease. Jerome Hughes in Brussels says the health experts are concerned that Europe's tough coronavirus restrictions will be inefficient amid the holiday season's indoor gatherings.
There is a great deal of concern that even those countries, you mentioned Germany, that increase the restrictions, that it won't work, because what we're going to happen is, as we approach Christmas and the New Year, you will have a lot of people congregating indoors, people coming home to their family homes. And so even with the restrictions in public areas, the big concern is that just private domestic residential houses are going to be hotspots for spreading this disease. Because if you listen to what some of the travel correspondents are reporting, there has been a spike in the number of bookings in terms of the aviation industry. People are booking flights home within the European Union itself. But also, perhaps more worryingly, there's a lot of people flying over from, say, the United States, which, of course, we know that Donald Trump handled the pandemic appallingly. And so the United States is a big concern, because a lot of people travel back from the US into the European Union. Experts say that there's no doubt that travel is what spreads this disease. So there's concern around that. And also getting the message out to young people. I mean, just anecdotally, I think we can all see it when we see young people, particularly young men, out on the street and so on. They're far more likely not to be wearing a mask or to be congregating in sort of closed in spaces together, too close, not adhering to the 1.5 meters and so on.
Petrol stations in Italy have begun a 3-day strike, calling on the government to include all station management firms in new COVID support measures. Max Civilli has more.
Italy's petrol station operators have been staging a strike since Monday to demand the Italian government being included among the recipients of support measures to mitigate the nefarious impact of the anti-COVID restrictions. It is the latest in a string of petrol station strikes over market conditions and aid measures during the pandemic emergency. In late November, another 3-day strike had been called by sector unions and organizations and staged on the country's motorways.
Petrol retailers' associations complained that gas stations suffered losses amounting to 90% of their revenues on Italy's motorways and about 60% of their income in urban areas during the lockdown. They say it is no longer possible to meet overheads and fixed costs in the current situation.
Small and very small petrol station operators have been excluded from receiving aid payments from the government because all petrol stations remained open during the lockdown. Considering the cancellation of sales due to COVID and restrictions, we are at risk of no longer being able to guarantee the opening of stations with continuity and regularity.
Last month, the Italian government issued a package of aid for the businesses and families most affected by the new anti-COVID restrictions. As many as 211,000 companies have received support funds, totaling over 960 million euros.
There's no doubt that support measures to businesses and families have helped a bit. Having said that, the situation remains critical for many, unfortunately.
New talks between the government and retail groups are likely to be held in the coming days. Petrol station operators are slated to end their strike on Thursday. Max Civilli, Rome.
The United States has set a new daily record of coronavirus infections with more than 248,000 new cases in 24 hours. The figure was registered by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday. Total confirmed COVID cases in the U.S. topped 16.7 million. This death toll is above 300,000. Infections have increased dramatically over the past month. The pandemic has taken a heavy toll on U.S. economy also. Congress leaders have held a second meeting to end a months-long standoff on the new virus relief package. They cited progress in the talks. Congress approved $3 trillion in aid in the spring. Since then, lawmakers have argued about whether more is needed. Indian farmers are keeping up protests against the recently passed agriculture laws that they argue would devastate their livelihoods. Prime Minister Narendra Modi says the new laws would benefit the farmers. He says the ongoing protests are being misled by what he calls some sort of conspiracy. But the farmers say that the laws are made to give capitalists a monopoly on the trade of agricultural produce.
Modi Sarkar! Modi Sarkar! Sanjukt Morcha! Sanjukt Morcha!
India has been the scene of mass anti-government protests since September. This after the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi introduced a reform bill, which was later passed into law, seeking to deregulate India's agricultural sector by setting a minimum support price, known as MSP, and allowing farmers to sell their crops to private buyers. Protesters, however, have a different understanding of the law. They accuse the government of Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party of aiming to benefit big corporations, leaving farmers at the mercy of a free market while they can sell crops at higher prices if the demand is there. They have called on all farmers to hold sit-in protests outside district offices throughout the country. On Monday, protest leaders and community organizers called for demonstrations to be held in all districts across the entire nation. They also intensified their agitation by calling on demonstrators to start a day-long hunger strike. In many of such events, protests have turned violent with police using military tactics, including water cannons and tear gas, against frustrated protesters to disperse them. Some were also beaten with batons. The law allows farmers to sell their produce outside government-controlled agricultural markets, which ensures prices wouldn't get too high. Modi says this will give farmers a chance to decide their own prices and sell directly to private businesses like grocery chains, which ultimately cut the traders and middlemen. Yet several rounds of negotiations between the government and protest leaders have had no tangible result. The farmers want authorities to completely repeal the law. Even a written proposal to the farmers' union, which laid out a series of amendments, including written assurances over MSP, has not stopped farmers from calling off their protests. Farmers say the amendments are just part of cosmetic changes to the law and it does not really change its character. They say the only way left for the farmers is to continue their protests until their demands are met.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden delivered a sharp repudiation of Donald Trump and declared that the will of the people had prevailed in a speech that came shortly after the Electoral College officially confirmed his election victory. It was time to turn the page on a presidential election that tested the resilience of American democracy, the president-elect said just moments after Hawaii cast the final four Electoral College votes, clearing a milestone that all but ended Donald Trump's unprecedented attempt to overturn the election results. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled Biden Hails Democracy and Rebukes Trump After Electoral College Victory. Stay with us for more of Lauren Gambino's article. Joe Biden delivered a sharp repudiation of Donald Trump and declared that the will of the people had prevailed in a speech that came shortly after the Electoral College officially confirmed his election victory on Monday, 14th of December. It was time to turn the page on a presidential election that tested the resilience of American democracy, the president-elect said, just moments after Hawaii cast the final four Electoral College votes, clearing a milestone that all but ended Donald Trump's unprecedented attempt to overturn the election results. Biden hailed the presidential election and its uncharted aftermath as a triumph of American democracy and one of the most amazing demonstrations of civic duty we've ever seen in our country. The final vote tally, 306 to 232 electoral votes, followed a baseless campaign by President Trump to reverse the results of an election that saw historic turnout despite the coronavirus pandemic. Trump lost not only in the Electoral College, but he also lost in the popular vote by nearly 7 million. Yet for weeks, the president has clung to meritless accusations of voter fraud in a slate of battleground states that delivered the victory to Biden. His refusal to concede has sowed doubt among his supporters, but the integrity of the vote and undermined faith in the institutions of American governance. In a speech delivered from Wilmington, Delaware, Joe Biden said, "Our democracy, pushed, tested, and threatened, proved to be resilient, true, and strong." Biden, who will become the 46th President of the United States when he's sworn into office on 20th of January, said, "We the people voted. The integrity of our election remains intact. And so now is the time to turn the page, as we've done throughout our history, to unite, to heal." Since Biden entered the presidential race last year, he has cast the election as a battle for the soul of the nation. In his remarks on Monday night, Joe Biden described his Electoral College victory as a fulfillment of that mission and a rejection of Donald Trump. The president-elect called Trump's assault on the democratic process unconscionable and assailed Republicans who embraced his unsubstantiated claims about widespread voter fraud. He singled out the 17 state attorney generals and 126 members of Congress who he said helped legitimize a legal effort to throw out tens of millions of votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, and hand the presidency to a candidate who lost the Electoral College, lost the popular vote, and lost each and every one of the states whose votes they were trying to reverse. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected the lawsuit. "These officials," Biden said, "adopted a position so extreme that we've never seen it before, a position that refused to respect the will of the people, refused to respect the rule of the law, and refused to honor our Constitution." Anticipating further resistance from Donald Trump and his allies, Joe Biden noted that the president and his campaign were denied no course of action, and stressed that their efforts failed in states with Republican governors and in courts with Republican-appointed judges. "They were heard," he said, "and they were found to be without merit." Meanwhile, President Trump has continued to dispute the legitimacy of the election on Monday, 14th of December, claiming that the result was rigged due to massive fraud. Twitter moved quickly to label the pronouncements by Donald Trump as disputed. As California's 55 electors cast their ballots for Joe Biden, pushing him over the 270-vote threshold to win the White House, Donald Trump announced on Twitter that his attorney general Bill Barr was resigning, effective from 23rd of December. Trump had recently lost patience with William Barr, viewed as a loyalist who eagerly advanced the president's political agenda, after the attorney general acknowledged that his department had found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. In a sign that Republicans were increasingly prepared to accept reality, some senators and members of Congress acknowledged the Electoral College vote. The orderly transfer of power is a hallmark of our democracy, and although I supported President Trump, the Electoral College vote today makes clear that Joe Biden is now president-elect, the Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio said in a statement. Joe Biden thanked the handful of Republican senators who have accepted the Electoral College vote after resisting his victory for weeks. Ever hopeful that 4 years of deep partisan division will yield a new era of bipartisanship, Biden said he was convinced we can work together for the good of the nation. With the election all but finalized, Joe Biden called on elected officials to turn to the urgent work of combating the coronavirus pandemic. On Monday, the U.S. death toll surpassed more than 300,000, a grisly reminder on the same day Americans began receiving the first shots of a vaccine against the virus. Though the path forward remains challenging, exacerbated by the divisions that persist, Joe Biden said the Electoral College vote should serve as a sign of hope for the nation. He pointed to the election officials, many of whom were volunteers, who carried out their duties in the face of the political pressure, threats of violence, and in some cases, an intervention from the president himself. Their unwavering commitment to the electoral process ensured that the flame of democracy was not extinguished, he said. Biden continued, "They showed a deep and unwavering faith in and a commitment to the law. They knew the elections they oversaw were honest and free and fair. They saw it with their own eyes, and they wouldn't be bullied into saying anything different."
Saudi Royal Family.
Part 3.
The U.S. Air Force fired uranium bullets at a convoy of troops with stolen Kuwaiti military equipment and vehicles on the Kuwait-Basra Highway, turning it into the Highway of Death. Political, security, and environmental consequences of this war left the region in a state of crisis for many years. The Saudi army, which was worth tens of billions of dollars, was practically inactive, and it was the armies of other countries in the world that rushed to its rescue. During the first phase of Ayyamama deal, Banda received £1 billion. A great part of the money was deposited into accounts in the main branch of Riggs Bank on Pennsylvania Street, just across from the White House. These accounts belong to members of the Saudi embassy, including Bandar bin Sultan, as well as official embassy accounts. It is an ideal bank for presidents, embassies, and ambassadors with close ties to the CIA. George W. Bush's uncle, Jonathan Bush, was the bank's chief executive. The strange point was that in 1999, a significant amount of this money was transferred from the account of Bandar's wife at the same bank to the accounts of two of the 15 Saudis involved in the 9/11 attacks, named Khalid al-Mihdhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. On May 4, 2004, The Guardian newspaper revealed allegations of corruption in Ayyamama deal. Several people in the Saudi royal family, as well as British politicians, were involved in this case, most notably Bandar bin Sultan and other Saudi princes such as Turki bin Nasser, deputy commander at the Royal Saudi Air Force, and Margaret Thatcher's son in Britain. But the directors of the BAE were the most important entities involved in Britain. The Guardian newspaper claimed that the company had bribed Bandar bin Sultan an amount of £1 billion during the deal. The Guardian's investigation showed that the BAE, with the assistance of Lloyds Bank, set up a secret network to transfer money to Red Diamond Bank accounts in the Virgin Islands to pay large bribes to politicians in various countries, including Saudi Arabia, in exchange for military contracts. Serious Fraud Office, or SFO, as part of the UK Attorney General's Office, started an extensive investigation. This department followed the links of this case in Britain as well as in the US. The continuation of this investigation caused concern to Saudi officials because they were looking for the third phase of Ayyamama deal. It was time for Bandar to return home because the investigations into his financial records as well as the follow-up of the press were causing problems for him. On September 8, 2005, he returned to Saudi Arabia. At the same time, Saudi Arabia threatened Tony Blair, the new British Prime Minister, that it will suspend its security cooperation with London on terrorism if they did not stop their investigation. Blair seriously warned all the members involved in the investigation, including the British ambassador to Saudi Arabia and the British Attorney General. Blair urged everyone at all levels to stop the investigation because it could threaten the British citizens' lives.
I don't believe the investigation incidentally would have led anywhere except to the complete wreckage of a vital strategic relationship for our country in terms of fighting terrorism, in terms of the Middle East, in terms of British interests there.
But threats became reality.
Breaking news we're getting from the PA Newswire that there's been reports of an explosion outside Liverpool Street Station.
July 7th, 2005, London bombings that killed 52 people and injured 700 others was a clear signal to the British government that it was time to end the investigation, and they stopped it shortly. The strange thing was that a few months later, Prince Bandar bin Sultan was the head of the Saudi National Security Council, and he was in charge of terrorist groups' files, including Al-Qaeda. In 2007, when the media controversy over corruption in Al-Yamama deal subsided, the Saudi king traveled to London and Bandar accompanied his father in the Saudi delegation. They had several meetings and Saudi Arabia signed a $20 billion contract with the BAE. Most countries were trying to take advantage of this lucrative market, but the United States was trying to get the most out of it.
Over the past 30 years, the United States has sold over $50 billion worth of military weapons and services to the Saudis, more than we've sold to any nation on earth.
And we have had, for more than 40 years now, a relationship and an agreement, mutual security agreement with the Saudi Arabians. And it has been beneficial to both of us.
Saudi Arabia has had the largest arms purchases from the U.S. among Arab countries since the 1950s. But the U.S. has been trying to play a bigger role in this market. This time, Washington was not worried anymore about shifting the balance of power between Saudi Arabia and Israel. As Barack Obama took office, many around the world hoped that U.S.'s approach to war and arms sales would change.
All of them. The Nobel Peace Prize laureate for 2009, President Barack Obama, to come forward and receive the gold medal and the diploma.
He was the fourth U.S. president to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in his first year in office.
So yes, the instruments of war do have a role to play in preserving the peace. And yet this truth must coexist with another, that no matter how justified, war promises human tragedy. The soldier's courage and sacrifice is full of glory, expressing devotion to country, to cause, to comrades in arms. But war itself is never glorious, and we must never trumpet it as such.
But the story was different. The interests of military industry were so great that all U.S. governments, both Democrat and Republican, sought to gain a greater share of this market. The Obama administration broke the record by signing the highest arms deal with Saudi Arabia in the history of relations between the two countries. According to Pentagon figures, the Obama administration exported $278 billion in arms sales to the world during his 8 years in office, and delivery of orders to Saudi Arabia alone amounted to $115 billion. After the Arab Spring protests in 2011 calling for change, Saudi Arabia worked hard to maintain its trusted friends in those countries, including Yemen and its former president Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was a Saudi royal family's old friend. Saudi Arabia could help Saleh, but they found another alternative. While the Yemeni government was trying to designate Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi as the president, economic and security problems were increasing day by day. Yemen's popular Houthi Ansarullah movement was trying to control the situation in Yemen by cooperating with individuals and parties such as Ali Abdullah Saleh, and the situation was getting better to some extent. This news was not in favor of Saudi Arabia, a country that had been influential in Yemen for years, so it started a bloody war against Yemen, a nation that is one of the most deprived Arab and Islamic countries. Yemen became the target of the most severe ground, aerial, and maritime strikes after a complete siege on this country. Saudi Arabia launched its offensive on March the 25th, 2015, forming a coalition of Arab governments and Western countries. The United States and Britain provided intelligence and weapons for Saudi Arabia on its war on Yemen. According to Saudi media, the offensive was supposed to end in a few days or at most a few weeks and the new government would fall, but the war continued for months and years. Saudi Arabia entered a battle in which it only had to be the winner and the other side had to surrender and lose. The apparent lack of success increased the intensity of the attacks against the Yemeni people every day. There were no military targets, and Saudis repeatedly used unconventional weapons in aerial bombardments during this war. Nowadays, many Western countries are considering canceling arms deals with Saudi Arabia due to the revelation of Saudi war on Yemen, the pressure of public opinion, and anti-war groups. But the US president continues to resist these pressures and is proud of his multi-billion dollar deals because the sale of these weapons has created tens of thousands of jobs in his country, and the killing of tens of thousands of Yemenis will not stop these deals. Donald Trump had promised to create hundreds of thousands of jobs in his election campaign. A significant number of these jobs, for sure, were in defense industry.
Hundreds of billions of dollars of investments into the United States and jobs, jobs, jobs. So I would like to thank all of the people of Saudi Arabia.
One of the biggest U.S. aids is air fueling operations for Saudi fighters in Yemen. Since the beginning of the war, more than 1,600 refueling operations have been carried out on 62 fighters of the Saudi-led coalition. This will extend the air assault of these fighters. Another strange point in the Saudi war on Yemen is that both Saudi Arabia and the UAE send weapons to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh against forces of Yemen's popular Houthi Ansarullah movement. This cooperation is clearly revealed in videos and photos of terrorists' weapons in various battle scenes. Weapons that Saudi Arabia is not allowed to deliver or sell to a group or even a third country in official contracts. You can easily find some of these weapons on the internet. like German Army MG3 machine gun. Russian RPG-32 laser-guided rockets, which are assembled in Jordan. Belgian FN Minimi. HG-85 grenade, SMO-3 from Switzerland. Steyr AUG assault rifle. Austrian Steyr SSG-69 used by Al-Qaeda allied forces in Yemen. These weapons are abundantly found in the hands of the Saudi armed forces. The American MATV mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles sent to the UAE can be seen in the hands of Abu al-Abbas battalion from Salafi groups linked to Al-Qaeda with the UAE and Yemeni flags on them, and there are also mine-clearing vehicles with Saudi logos easily used in Al-Qaeda-controlled areas. In October 2017, the United States placed Abu al-Abbas Salafist Battalion forces on the list of terrorist organizations for supporting and associating with Al-Qaeda, and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates also supported the U.S. designation. While Saudi Arabia and the UAE continued to send weapons, equipment, and financial aid to Abu al-Abbas Salafist Battalion forces. However, in 2018, Germany signed a new deal worth $400 million with Saudi Arabia. Despite political tensions between Canada and Saudi Arabia in 2018, Ottawa's $13 billion arms deal with Riyadh to build light armored vehicles is still valid. Blocking this contract will result in several billion euros in fines and the loss of thousands of jobs in Canada. Spain remains committed to go ahead with the sale of 400 laser-guided bombs to Saudi Arabia, a contract that was signed in 2015. These bombs will definitely be used in the war against the Yemeni people because Saudi Arabia has threatened to cancel the $2 billion contract to build 5 Corvette warships with Spain if these bombs are not sent to them. And this story continues. According to Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, in 2017, Saudi Arabia was the third largest arms importer in the world. Interestingly, since 2013, about 61% of these arms purchases are from the United States. So it is not surprising that all Saudi military operations in Yemen are backed by arms dealers, especially the US and Britain, which together supply 84% of the Saudis' weapons. France, Spain, and Germany are next on the list in arms sales to Saudi Arabia. All the governments of the last half century in the United States and Britain have agreed on one point with their differences on various issues, and that is to sell more and more weapons to Saudi Arabia.
Wonderful. So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen, and the Riman colleagues. When I joined Harvey Nichols, it is the department store that was owned by the Alpha International Company. I was the CEO of the company. The experience that I had walking through the halls of the store, that there was not one woman on the floor.
Saudi media reported in early 2019 that Bandar bin Sultan's daughter, Rima, was appointed Saudi ambassador to Washington. It was a critical choice, indicating that everything is still based on family and tribal ties, and key positions remain in the hands of Abdulaziz Al Saud's sons even a century after the establishment of the Saudi kingdom. Now, Rima works in her father's former office at the Saudi embassy in Washington. On April the 3rd, 2019, the world media talked about the completion of a nuclear research reactor in Saudi Arabia, which was even more surprising. This nuclear research reactor gives access to an atomic bomb to an ambitious person like Mohammed bin Salman, and holding the atomic bomb in his hand means threatening peace and tranquility throughout West Asia and even the world.
Thank you very much, everybody. It's a great honor to have the Crown Prince with us. Saudi Arabia has been a very great friend and a big purchaser of equipment and lots of other things, and one of the biggest investments in the United States is their, I guess it's your big investment, is buying stock in companies and various other things in the United States and creating jobs. We've become very good friends over a fairly short period of time. I was in Saudi Arabia in May, and we are bringing back hundreds of billions of dollars into the United States, and we understand that, and they understand that some of the things that have been approved and are current.
Yemen is still resisting, and it seems unlikely that Mohammed bin Salman's multi-billion dollar purchase from the U.S. president would solve Saudi Arabia's problems in Yemen, despite all the weapons used by Saudi Arabia and its allies.
Should have increased it. $880 million, $645 million, $6 billion, that's for frigates. $889 million, $63 million, and that's for various artillery. Some of the things that we're now working on, thanks, and that have been ordered and will shortly be started in construction and delivered. THAAD system, $13 billion.
And the sword dance continues.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.